This episode is sponsored by Sanebox, a great way to focus on the important emails and boost your productivity.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Going from bad to worse as markets take a beating. Voluntary and mandated shutdowns are going to hit the economy, and we're all pondering the question, when will this end? And our guest today, Allison Ostrander from Simpler Trading and Vitaly Katsenelson from Investment Management Associates. All this and much more on episode number 654 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, here we are in some very, very difficult times. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of The Disciplined Investor, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged with John C. Dvorak as my co-host, where we come together each and every Tuesday evening at 9 o'clock, live streaming with chat. So if you haven't had the opportunity to spend some time over there, I encourage you to do so. But, these are really tough times. It's not what anyone could have really expected. Even the most bearish of investors, I don't think, could have caught this incredible and rapid and volatile environment right. Yeah, there's a lot of guys you're going to hear about, oh, we called this. And nobody knew that this particular virus and this health condition was going to spread so rapidly to a point where we have to shut down businesses, shut down the cruise lines, shut down basically the airlines, transportation, entire communities, restaurants, hotels. No. So if they're telling you that, they're trying to woo you in with, I told you, we knew this, we had this. Come on. I don't even think the doomsday preppers out there had thought this would ramp up as quickly as it did. And that's the problem. The difference between what we're seeing now and what's happened over the last several weeks and other times in history can't be compared. You know, we had started talking about this coronavirus. I even mentioned a few weeks ago that somebody was all pissed off that all we talk about is the coronavirus, because we knew there was going to be some issue and there was going to be an economic hit on a global basis. But I got to tell you, this is unprecedented. The information that was flowing was flawed. Okay. It was hard to really understand that. The testing wasn't being done in the U.S. And that ramp up, like I said, was quite incredible. But I want to tell you something. I want to make something very clear that all of us, we're in this together now. No one's exempt from the potential of infection. And it's a really scary situation. And whatever you're feeling right now, I want to stress this. You're not alone. Even if your portfolio is all in cash and your job is guaranteed, you know what? You're probably really nervous. Yes, of course, if you have losses in the markets and your 401k plans and questioning whether or not you're going to be able to work for the next several weeks, or even who knows what happens after that, it's even scarier. But you know what? We're all having the same level of concern. Anxiety may be a little higher for some people than others, but we're all anxious. We're all cooped up. We can't really, with confidence, go out anywhere and shake hands with people, hug people, go to a restaurant. Of course, a lot of closed. Even takeout is like, do I want to do that? Do I want to go to the store? Who knows who's got what and who's infected? And this is a very unique situation. And the question that you're all asking about when will this be over is what we're all asking. So I want you to understand that this is something that is hitting everybody around the world. I've been getting emails from people in South Africa that's not really hit that hard. I've been getting emails from friends in India. Again, not hit that hard, but they're concerned. Russia, very little outbreak there. I'm getting emails saying, hey, how are things going? We're really nervous about what's going on. We're taking precautions. And it's really a situation that is very, very concerning, very disconcerting. And we have 401ks that are being thrashed. Even the best stocks are being taken out to the woodshed and, I mean, beaten up beyond recognition. This week, we saw that markets were down, what, 17% for the major markets? The worst week in decades. And that's on top of a massive drop that we saw before that. So, no, this is serious stuff. But again, I'm going to stress, I'm going to be here trying my best to make some sense of all this. Now, listen, technical patterns, they're broken. Fundamentals, unclear. And the outlook is kind of, well, unknown. And that's the problem. The general uncertainty that we're seeing with all in regard to earnings and outlook and how long things are going to be closed. The economics, and our lives. So this isn't like 2008 when we didn't have a job and maybe houses were going to be repossessed and you weren't able to pay your cars and people were out of work for an extended period of time. And it was like, okay, well, you can still go out and do things. I mean, New York is under a lockdown. You have to stay basically in your house, in your apartment, work from home. It's really difficult. I've been doing this a long time. And this is nothing even close to what I've seen before in my lifetime. From the impact on social life, impact on the markets, impact on outlook for economics, and the entire world. I've tried to look back on other really tough times that are out there. You know, when you have maybe the ability to say, well, this is like this. Remember, a lot of people were talking about, well, this is like the SARS epidemic. Came and went, and, you know, economics were a question, and kind of we were fine after that. We saw a bit of a drop down, and then mostly in other places, didn't really hit us hard here. That was BS, because it's nothing like that. And maybe we could best say that, okay, this is like a wartime environment because everybody is pretty much around the world in the same situation, concerned about their lives, concerned about their finances, concerned about their loved ones, concerned about what's going to happen tomorrow. And the news flow doesn't help any of this, right? I mean, the news flow is in your face on a constant basis about the number of infections, the numbers of deaths, the number of places closing down. London's closed today. Now we got California, parts of that closed. The nursing home situation, I mean, it doesn't stop. Then we got the Treasury and the Fed and the administration and Congress all throwing out potential plans and stimulus. And this now happens in the U.S. Then we see something happen in London. Then we see something happen in the EU. Then we have China and Japan. I mean, it's just nonstop. 24/7 getting alerts on my phones from all sorts of places about just everything that's going on. My local community, my county, my state, the U.S., the world. I mean, it's tough. So do what a lot of people are doing, I guess. Get out every once in a while. Go for a walk. Obviously, do the social distancing thing. But try to maintain some course of a life throughout this, because the last thing you want to do is sit in front of your TV on a constant basis and just watch this and get mired in, oh my God, look what's happening. Oh my God, look at my portfolio. Oh, look what's happening, my friend. Look what's happening. You want to just take a deep breath. We talked about this last week. Take it in through the nose and out through the mouth. This too shall pass. I will tell you that when I did look back and I did look at some comparisons of other times that we saw some major disruptions, again, very different. You know, I looked at the like 73, 75 analog. People are bringing back the whole, you know, big market crash in the earlier part of the 1900s and 29 and 30s. And I don't know if we're there. This is more of a temporary situation that's going to have long-lasting effects. But yes, it's going to end eventually. If it's not, what's the point of even talking about this anyway? But it is going to end. It's going to calm down. We're going to go through the cycle. That's my best guess, at least, in a couple of months, whenever exactly that time period is that we start seeing that the spiking of infection rates that we are seeing here in the United States and Italy, around the world, are going to slow down. We are doing some extraordinary things on a social basis to tamp down some of the concern. But I'm not going to try to guess at what the immediate future holds. That would just be stupid. What I can say now, I think, is that if we look out further, there is some sunshine in the future. In the short term, probably the economic fallout is going to be pretty significant. However, I do at the same time think that once this is all cleared up and once we see that infection rate spike and then slow down and maybe even slope lower, start to like just get a little bit under control, that we may have a major bounce in the economy. Once we can get, you know, relieved from these confinement orders and we see something of an end to this whole thing. And probably ahead of that, we're going to see the markets bounce. Markets are a bit forward-looking, and I think there'll be some kind of a significant bounce. I mean, think about all of the stimulus that's been pushed into the economy by governments around the world, the checks that will be going out directly to individuals, the postponement of taxes, the buying of bonds, municipal bonds, corporate bonds by governments and sovereigns, and a lot of people that have some money on the sidelines that they may say, hey, you know what? There's some value out there. Stocks are definitely going to be ahead of the curve, in my opinion, although I think that we will see an eventual bounce. Probably there's also going to be a period in there that bounce peters out and we see a bit of a slowdown again in terms of the market's potential for that bounce and comes back down. So I want you to be aware that this is kind of a normal pattern. The, hey, you know what? Let's get in right now. Or people waiting to get out at certain levels. And then once it gets to that point and it starts screaming higher, maybe for a period of, I don't know, a couple of months, they're going to see the impact of the economy and earnings continue to filter through, may get concerned, may get scared, and we may see another move lower. So you need to be aware that we are in extraordinarily volatile times and try to take advantage of some of that volatility for your future. For those of you that were all in on the stock market and you didn't sell anything and you believe, hey, you know what? I got a long time. I'm not going to argue with you. If you think that maybe 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 2 years from now, that we'll be back and, you know, all this will be pushed into the past as this horrible event that was very contained in terms of time frame. I'm not going to argue with you there. I think probably 401k holders should continue to dollar cost average in to a well-balanced, well-diversified portfolio. I think that's the smartest thing that you could probably do. But aside from all that, and I seriously, we've been around for a long time doing this, you and I. We've been talking back and forth over a decade, more than that. And what I want to impart to you today, and I can't stress this enough, again, we're all feeling this one way or another. It's scary from every angle. But one thing I can't promise you, I don't know what's going to happen with the markets. I don't. Right now, I can't give you an outlook. I know that in the end of the year, last year into this year, I was talking about valuations were way out of whack and bring down your equity exposure. But again, no matter how much equity exposure you had at this point, kind of a tough time. Some would have fared a lot better if you didn't get caught up in that whole momentum trade that was going on. But even so, it's not pretty. I can promise you one thing. I will be personally here for you each and every week to try to make some sense out of this whole mess. And we all have to do our part to be there for one another. And I'm there for you. In fact, we're going to start holding these after-hour pop-up webinars. We had one last week. each and every week. We'll have maybe, depending on how things go, once, twice, maybe even three times per week at 4:30 in the afternoon, answering any questions you have. Just maybe, if nothing else, to be there as a sounding board, support system, and sharing some thoughts on what's going on. So what you can do, if you want to be a part of that, you can either follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, and I'll post it there when it's going to happen. And I'll also post it to our mailing list. If you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, go to the bottom there. There's a pop-up that will pop up, and you could put your email address in there, and you'll get those announcements. Or what you could do is on the bottom of the homepage, there's a little area to sign up for the mailing list as well, and I'll send out those announcements. So let's be there for each other, shall we? We'll get through this. We are going to get through this. Now, before we get to our guests, I want to talk about something that I think is kind of important, and that's about this great product called SaneBox. So if you're like me, you get a good amount of emails every day, right? And the nonstop onslaught of spam and advertisements is super distracting. And you get so many unimportant emails, right? Yes, we've all tried to get to this inbox zero thing. But to be real, these days it's more and more difficult to kind of sift through all of those that come into your inbox every hour of every single day. And if you're like me, it's no longer about the idea of responding to everything. It's about responding only to the important things, you know, the messages that truly matter. And that's where SaneBox comes in. Think of it as a powerful AI service for your email. As messages flow in, SaneBox works behind the scenes to separate the important from the unimportant, leaving only the important emails in your inbox and directing all the other distracting stuff to your Sane Later folder. It also has some really cool features like Sane Black Hole, where you can drag messages from annoying senders you never want to hear from again, and Sane Reminders to ping you if someone hasn't replied to your email by a certain date. And you can use SaneBox with any email client or phone anywhere that you check your mail. That's what I like about it so much. It's really easy to use. So check this out. You can see how SaneBox can pretty much magically remove distractions and all this junk in your email with a 2-week free trial. You can visit SaneBox.com/TDI to start your free trial and get a $25 credit. That's SaneBox.com/TDI. Check it out today. All right, how about we get to our guests? And our first guest today is Allison Ostrander from Simpler Trading. And she really works in the area of risk management and options and does a lot of work in the trading community, and she has a little girl or baby with her today as she is homing it due to all this is going on. Allison, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. I mean, fortunately, I'm able to still use my office because we've kind of segregated who's here and who's not, but I understand working from the house. But doesn't it make it a little bit tougher than being in the office?
It has its pros and cons, right? I love not having to commute roughly an hour to work and back each day, but trying to hold a baby in one arm and do trading in the other and watch the charts, it can be a little tiring.
Yeah. So tell me, tell everybody what exactly you do and how you really view and approach the markets.
Yeah, so I am an options trader. That is my main focus when it comes to trading. And I definitely keep an eye on my overall risk. I have a few rules just for my account that I go through, so I never overextend my account, as well as just with my options trades themselves. But I do a lot of intraday style trading, as well as longer term swing trades on the indexes and any symbol that to me has a good technical setup on it.
So there are those setups that you may have where you have an option and you're really holding it for a very short period of time, and I guess those that you hold for a while.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you find those options that have the potential in a normal environment, not like we're in now, but in a normal environment where there's, you know, not that much volatility, and options really thrive on volatility and make money utilizing options on a very short-term basis?
Well, there are a lot of different ways you can play it. So if there's a long-term pick that I like that looks like a great setup on a daily, weekly, and monthly time frame where it just looks like it's going to continue to go to the upside, I don't mind going out in time, getting something like a long call that's in the money, and then playing it higher. If the long call is just too expensive for my account, then I look more at spreads. That's a great way to be able to minimize your risk and still allow for a decent profit on the trade and on the move that you're setting up for.
So when we get into situations like we have now with the extreme volatility, and we've seen that correlations are broken and the VIX is all-time high, option pricing is ridiculous. How do you determine if the particular spread that you're working with, however that may be set up, is actually going to work the way you want it to?
Well, for me, certainly if there's a lot of open interest, a lot of liquidity still in that symbol, for example, SPX, like the index or something like Amazon, it's still easy to get a fill at the bit, at the mark between the bid and ask, both when you're opening and closing a trade. And certainly in volatility, you see a lot of extrinsic value build into these option strikes. So in regards to spreads, credit spreads are a great way to take advantage of this market, because you can get all of that extrinsic value, get a pretty good premium on a credit spread. And then if it still moves in your direction, just let that get worthless and take the credit that you locked in as an overall profit.
So what are the things that right now in terms of volatility that you're looking at? Is it mostly like credit spreads, or is it looking at just, hey, you know what? Let's pick up some calls on some of these names that have been so beaten down. I mean, ridiculous. But, you know, even with that, I've been looking at some options and the pricing is still pricing in a lot of volatility. So you need to have a much wider range of potential strike prices, right?
Absolutely. And it's also good that, for example, if you've seen a huge drop and it looks like it's going to at least see some sort of reversal back up, kind of like what we're getting with SPX today, you can go further out of the money on a spread, still get a really low risk tolerance with a great profit potential, and then play for that volatile move back up, and then find that spread all of a sudden that was way out of the money one day, back in the money the next day.
So you mentioned you're looking at charts. So one of the things about charts, I think a lot of people get confused about this. It's, you're not charting the option, are you? You're charting the underlying, right?
Absolutely, yes. 100% charting the underlying price, looking at a lot of different things on my charts. If you saw them, you might be like, what are you seeing here? But I've found with the indicators that I use, when they start to come in line with each other, it makes for an excellent signal to either go bullish, bearish, or sometimes it gives me a consolidating signal, which can still be great with the option market to take trades for sideways range.
So have you found any problem recently with the whole market tumult in terms of, hello, I think she wants you to make a trade.
She has been her own little indicator in this market, certainly speaking.
But when you see this kind of volatility, is there a particular, is this something you're looking at different now than you were looking at, let's say, just, I don't know, a month ago?
Yeah. So in this volatility, I've really been focusing on intraday style trades. And I actually have a strategy that I use where I'm able to avoid that pesky day trading rule and still be able to lock in a profit and protect my capital. So in volatile markets like this, it's actually a great time for me to use that strategy. Or if you are able to day trade, to just consider doing that. I mean, the ranges that we're seeing that used to take a few weeks to turn out are turning out just within a day. So to be able to jump in and jump out rather quickly and still be in cash overnight, I have found to be very less stressful in this market to be able to trade it with.
So if you were thinking that either the market's going to zero right now with all that's going on, or something really bad, or if you were looking at the market recovering, let's say, I don't know, 2 months from now, 3 months from now, whatever, not recovering maybe the all-time highs, but settling out, would you be buying in the money puts or calls or out of the money?
It depends on the symbol for myself, just because I still want to stay within the risk tolerance for my account. I have a certain rule where I try not to invest more than 50% in my account. That way I'm still able to pay myself in case I have a bad week or something. Mm-hmm. But overall, ideally, I'd be looking at in the money calls to buy to play for that move up. One, because they already hold part intrinsic value for being in the money. And two, when they have a higher delta like that, once things really start to take back to the upside, it's only going to increase in value very nicely for me. And it's still a lot cheaper than buying into the shares of something like Amazon, for example.
But one of the things is, if you do get lucky, or maybe it's skill, and you bought something way outside the money, it's really cheap a lot of times, but yet you're probably still doesn't catch up as well as in the money options? Because all you're going to lose is the time premium on in the money option, right?
Right, exactly. And the other thing you need to be careful about with the out of the money options, especially at this time, is there's so much intrinsic value still built up into them. So if for some reason the price sees a move up, but it does not hit your strike or, you know, hits the break even point, even for that strike that's out of the money, you're still going to end up with a loss. So even though it's still more expensive to go in the money, the fact that it still has that intrinsic value there is great. And once this market starts to pop up, we'll see that volatility start to drop back down. And in turn, all that extrinsic value will start to be sucked out of these options in general. So, you know, unless you catch it at the right end or maybe give yourself a lot of time on an out of the money strike, that's why ideally I would still be leaning towards in the money whenever we do see the bounce back in the market to the upside.
So what's the real benefit of working with options versus just the stocks themselves or index or futures?
Well, options give you a lot of flexibility, right? So I'm able to play this to the downside right now by getting into puts. I'm able to play it to the upside. There are certainly a lot of different spread strategies out there where you can play it in more a non-directional sense, like iron condors and butterflies for a bit more sideways trading charts that are a bit more choppy. So that's what I love about options is you're not just buying shares and hoping the price is going to go in one direction. You have a lot of flexibility to be able to trade any sort of chart in any sort of market.
So are you teaching this on a daily basis to your subscribers?
Absolutely, yes. We have a live trading room that we're in each day, a group of us traders who give our insights, talk about what we see on the charts, talk about trade setups and strategies. And we have a whole bunch of classes and learning centers where we really dive in deep to try and teach you how to fish, if you will. So that way, if you don't want to be in the room all the time, or maybe you have your own schedule that you're working to, you can still take this knowledge and apply it for yourself to help grow your account.
Yeah. So I had a pop-up webinar this week where I said, you know what, let's just do it after the close of the market. Let's just do a quick, hey, ask me questions, fire them at me, and I'll see if I can come up with some solutions for you. And one of the things that came up I thought was really interesting was the idea of market shutdowns. Now, you don't hear this under normal circumstances, hardly ever hear this, but, you know, anything can happen, right? For the Philippines was closed for a couple of days, opened up 24% down. But let's assume there is a market shutdown. And let's say that market shutdown also coincides with the expiration date of one of your options. And let's say it's thinking crazy here. 2 weeks shutdown, your option expiration is tomorrow. What happens?
Well, from my understanding, and I haven't traded through this, to be quite frank, because the last time I remember a market shutdown was back during 9/11. I was still in high school at that time.
Yep.
But
I was too. I was in elementary school.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So it would end up cash settling, basically. And then just I would imagine if it's slightly in the money, it would cash settle. You might be assigned the stock itself, depending on the type of strategy you have, or it will just end up being worthless, right, if it's out of the money. So to protect myself from that ever being the case, what I always look to do is keep my risk in mind. I'm never over-investing in one trade. I'm never over-investing in my account. So if, God forbid, that happened tomorrow and all my expirations are certainly short-dated at this point, all those trades would end up either settling or closing out for nothing, but it wouldn't wipe out my account. It certainly wouldn't be able to keep me still from jumping back in and trading once the market opens up again.
Hmm. So what kind of things can you tell we've had people that talk about options before, but a lot of times I get a lot of emails about, hey, can you give me some good options trading, training books or places? And, you know, I want to understand because options, it's not as simple as saying, I like Amazon. I look at the PE ratio, I look at the fundamentals, I look at the chart. Not that easy. What can you tell them?
Well, certainly there are a few books out there that are great to learn. There's also just a lot of online knowledge that you could go to YouTube itself. Mastering the Trade by John Carter. He is
I know John.
The main person here at Simpler Trading. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. His book is wonderful to start off with if you want to try and jump into the markets. And we at Simpler Trading ourselves do have a YouTube page out there with a lot of free information available. But it's all about discipline and really practicing, right? So you dive in and really want to learn the information. If you're half-hearted about it, that's where you can get in trouble as a trader. Even if you have a few good wins, oftentimes I see people who get overeager about it. That in turn is how they overinvest their account and usually end up with a blowout to where I'm getting emails of, how do I recover this? And
yeah.
It's kind of hard to answer them in that case.
So what platform do you use? What is your favorite platform for discovering and looking at and comparing options?
Well, certainly Thinkorswim from the TDA Ameritrade platform. Mm-hmm. I love for the charting. I have used that a lot. And I've been with a lot of different brokerage platforms. I've been with Trade Monster before, they got bought out. I was with Options Express before Charles Schwab bought them out, and then I was with them. And so I've been around the board. And I got to say, my top two favorites are Tastyworks and Thinkorswim with TD Ameritrade. Thinkorswim, just because the charting is outstanding. It's what I always use to make my trades, and it's one of the longest platforms I've been with. And I like Tastyworks because their commissions are overall cheap. And I think the simplicity of using the option side of their platform is amazing. It's so simple and straightforward and easy to use that certainly as a newer trader, it's one that I would recommend for executing orders.
Yeah. I've used all those, actually a few of those. We like TradeStation just because we do. But, it's kind of different. It's also, isn't it what you get used to, right? At first,
absolutely.
At first, like, what the hell are all these buttons? And then over time, you get kind of, I could deal with this. You get used to it on a regular basis. So that's great. Well, we're going to put your information on how to get in touch with you, the areas where people could learn and learn more about the options trading over on the episode, 654 on the show notes. So I want to appreciate you for coming aboard, both of you, for coming aboard today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Okay, have a great day.
You too.
And our next guest is Vitaly Katsenelson. And he is a prolific writer, loves classical music. And you can find him on what's called Contrarian Edge, as well as his podcasts of his articles and things that he's talked about and his philosophy on investor.fm. And we've had him on before and we have him back. Vitaly, what's going on, man?
Andrew, how are you?
Andrew,
how are you?
I'm struggling with the shelter-in-place concept. I'm not really good at staying inside.
I understand.
Just
try to spend time with your family and just take it slow and enjoy and just try to enjoy, your kids and your wife and all.
So let's talk a little bit about what's going on with this and a general game plan, because it's a very fluid situation with lockdowns happening, new information flowing, constant media attention. We've gotten away from all the incredible amount of ridiculous political stuff. Now it's just coronavirus alert on every station, everywhere you go. Nobody's kind of really desirous of being with other people due to the social distancing. And stocks are kind of doing their social distancing from portfolios right now, as we're seeing that markets are very concerned about the potential for what could be a cataclysmic steep recession over the next two quarters. So kind of how do you deal with this?
Yeah, so I originally I was going to approach this as a kind of another recession, and I realized this is the wrong approach. Because what we have today, like in 2008, we basically had a run on the bank kind of issue. Where today we have a run on the economy. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by this, like I'll bring up Disney. We don't own the stock, but just think about my analysis, what I'm going through. In 2008, the occupancy with Sparks maybe declined from, 90% or 95% to 60%. Mm-hmm. Today, its Spark went from to zero. Yeah. Its ESPN revenues went from whatever, not down 30% or 20% like they were in 2008, but to nothing or almost nothing, right? So, and if you think about retailers, you think about a lot of businesses, that's what they're going through. So in our research today, I'm spending in addition to everything else I was doing, like I was, trying to figure out, I want to be in this business. I was analyzing management. I was trying to value the company, looking at the balance sheet. Now I'm spending a lot of time also looking at liquidity.
Right.
Can this company actually, so the value of any asset is a present value of future cash flows. There is an assumption that when you do the present value of cash flows 3 years from now, the company is still around, right? Mm-hmm. So in our research, I'm spending so much more time now on liquidity. Okay, can this company you know, get through next 6 months, next year, maybe next 2 months. We don't know, right? That's the problem. We have no idea how long it's gonna, you know, how long it's gonna take. But I want to make sure in our stock picking today, we are just, you know, spending a lot more time looking at liquidity. So everything else, or like looking for high quality companies, great management, all these things you and I talked to, you know, about before, plus this. And I think actually, I'll be honest, this is, let me just, before I sound horrible, let me just tell you the human toll, the impact on the economy, all these things. I get it. I'm not excited about that, you know. But as a value investor, as a person who stewards somebody else's capital, if you came to our office today, you would see people who are smiling and happy because we are just, you know, I think as from a portfolio perspective, this may help us to actually increase our returns in the long run, because suddenly there are values out there available that I can I'm literally going to the grocery store and these avocados that used to be $6, now I can buy them as, you know, for $1. And so I'm excited.
So, but what the problem is that you probably agree that if you find that company that has the staying power and you're looking more at the balance sheets right now, or adding that in as an important component on top of the cash flow and cash flow statements and all that. But the problem is that even if you find a solid company, due to the fact of the way the markets are these days with so many ETFs and passive investments, I think you would agree that you could still have some pain on the short-term basis.
Well, first of all, yes, I agree with you 100%. Let me tell, I'm going to give you two answers to this. Number one, any decision I make today, I expect to be wrong tomorrow. From perspective that whatever I'm going to buy today, tomorrow, I expect it to be lower. That's point number one. Point number two, it's very important to maintain time horizon that it goes beyond tomorrow, beyond 6 months. You know, every decision I make today, I want to look at it from 3-year perspective. Am I going to be happy that I made these decisions today from 3 years from now? But there is a point number three. We are doing today something that I never thought a value investor would be saying. I'm microdosing. Like I'm buying stocks in small doses, microdosing. So in the past, if I would buy, let's say we have a 20, 30 stock portfolio, I would buy 3 or 5% position as initial position, or it could be whatever, 3% position. Today, I'm buying 1% position today, then 50 basis points tomorrow. So I'm buying in smaller increments. And, you know, and also one thing I've been doing, because the sell-off was indiscriminate, I'm allowed to diversify a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll give an example. So in the past, if I would just buy, like I was looking at defense sector, for instance, I would buy one or two stocks. Today I can buy 4 stocks and just make positions smaller. So you kind of, you're able to diversify, but there is no cost to me right now because everything is down.
But with that, I get that. And I understand your point totally, 100%. With, hey, you know what? We're going to buy a position in ABC stock. We think that this can withstand the stress, at least from what we're seeing, right? You could be wrong, but yeah, what we're seeing. Yeah. And we're going to buy that. We think the value is very, very good. And it is something that's going to be around in the future. And the price that we're buying at is a bargain compared to where this should be. Okay, put that there. Now,
yes.
How then do you explain this in a rational way with a client, let's say, that may be acting irrationally due to the fact that maybe they think, you know what, I do have a long-term time horizon. I'm, you know, 40 years old. I do have a long-term time horizon. However, I don't want to have to deal with this up and down. And that may say this isn't your client then. But, you know, and then on top of it, I'm not sure about my job. I'm not sure about this. You know, obviously, people are acting irrationally because if we thought that this is going to be a major problem for the economy, and then potentially a U or a V or an L or a W, whatever shape you want to look at from an economic and a stock market basis, and we say that we're going into a deep recession, and usually we see a 40 or 50% cut on stock prices during that time. We're only about 35% down on the major indices, small caps down about 38%. How do you then manage the client's expectations? Isn't that important?
So, yeah, no, absolutely. My job as a money manager, it's if I ran a mutual fund, it would be just, yeah, you know, I would never meet my clients, right? It's just kind of, you run faceless money.
Mm-hmm.
I run separate accounts, and therefore I know, you know, I talk to every single client, you know, my firm has. So my job is to make sure that my clients also make rational decisions. And the way we do it, so the way we have made several adjustments. Number one, so in the past, I would communicate to clients 4 times a year, and I would write 20, 25-page letters where I would walk them through every single decision in the portfolio, this kind of thing.
Wow.
So it's,
that's pretty intense.
Yes. Today, we went to, I write to higher frequency. I write them a letter every single week. Okay, but it's not as long. So it's a depth, you know, I'm sacrificing depth versus, you know, for frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And in the letter, basically, like the last letter I wrote, which actually available on contrarianedge.com, where I actually walk them through a game plan. Okay. I say, here is how we're going to approach this. And I try to explain what I see and how we're going to do, you know, how we're going to approach them. And I try to set the expectations. And then like this, you know, this, and this week I'm going to spend Saturday and Sunday working the letter, basically walking through every position, maybe not as much in depth as I would otherwise do otherwise, but explaining why I think this company is not going anywhere, why this company is worth this much, and why, most importantly, this company will be able to get through the crisis. So I think today communication is incredibly important. And there's one more point. If client, the people, the money I'm managing today are not the money that people are going to use to buy groceries tomorrow.
Correct.
Right? And I think that is the key point. If that was the money, I would never take that money. In fact, if we took it, it would be sitting right now in a balanced account, and that would be sitting in basically treasuries, right? So we have some clients who have a balanced accounts where it's equity and fixed income. And fixed income literally would be sitting in six months or 1 year treasuries. Okay. So nothing is happening to that, you know, nothing is happening to that money. So the money that invested in equities today are the money that they need 5, 10, 15 years from now. And from that perspective, that is the best thing that ever happened to them. Really,
right,
you know,
because
their returns will be higher 5 years from now because of that. And easy for me to say a little bit, because we went into this with cash and we were hedged. So, our portfolio still declined, but they declined, you know, somewhat less. And we have options now became a source of cash as well. So this
I get that. I mean, listen, we came into this for other reasons, not the coronavirus, because this was, let's be honest, you could have seen this, but you had to really be a magician and a fortune teller to really understand how fast this would go in the wrong direction. I mean, there was definite signs on this that there was a problem. But in the years past with this kind of thing, it never really got to here, if you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It never got to Europe the way it was. And then once it happened, all hell broke loose, right? So one of the things that we said, and you probably would agree with me, was I have been hawking over the last year, ever since the pivot, but halfway through that the Fed artificially bumped markets and valuations were so out of whack that we came in much lighter on equity exposure for any one of our particular models, right? For anybody, if you were a moderate risk, and let's just say that moderate risk is usually a, I don't know, 60-40 blend of something like that. Just, to, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah. We came in like moderate minus minus. You know, we came in well down, and people, we didn't get that big return at the end of last year, but we're also, you know, taking, a much less of a downside. Now, unfortunately, last week, everything got sold, right? It was a bad week for everything. I don't care if you had bonds, if you had stock, it doesn't matter
what you had.
Gold, I mean, everything was sold. Let's not even talk about commodities. But I guess the point now is, now that you have some dry powder and you have the opportunity to invest with the knowledge, I think that you believe that this is going to be a pretty rough go around for the economy and therefore stocks. What you're saying is your game plan is to dollar cost average, or you call it microdosing, into the portfolio in the names that you really like. What's going to happen if one of the names, I don't know why, things happen, right? If this goes on longer and you're like, you know what, maybe we were a little off on our calculations on that. That's part of the play, right? To constantly review?
Absolutely. I mean, I just, you know, I think you need to be able to change your mind, right? And I think that... And as this is evolving, and today, like part of the analysis we're doing, we are also looking who are the customers of the product that this company makes, right? So if you are on the healthcare side, for instance, customers a lot of times are based on government or insurance companies, right? Or which, you know, so, you know, I feel somewhat okay with that. If you're buying defense stocks, I mean, like really, like I'm talking about the companies that make weapons, the government is the customer. So I feel fine about this. But if I'm buying something in the travel, like let's say hypothetically, I'm buying something in the travel space.
Boeing. Boeing's the perfect example. Even though they have defense, the customers of Boeing are the plane manufacturer, airlines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that becomes a lot more difficult, right? And so we are looking, for instance, we are looking in a travel space, but we're not looking at airlines because it's just, so one goal I have, after all this is over, I want to come out with that, with businesses I would like to own, you know, in the normal environment too. Like, so I'm not a big fan of airlines in general. So when there's the reason I'm not touching airlines, because this is not the businesses I would want to own in a normal environment.
Right. What about cruises?
I'm sorry?
What about cruise lines?
Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, they are just, if you analyze the business very carefully, they never make any money. I mean, just, they depreciate their cruise ships over, if I get 30 years, and the real life of the cruise, is not really, the ship is less than that because, who wants to take a 30-year-old ship? So you need to keep upgrading it all the time. So this is now, but at the same time, and we haven't bought it yet, but we're spending a lot of time analyzing online travel agencies, right? Because that is actually a phenomenal business. It's asset light, high return on capital, and that's the business who get impacted, right? Because today their revenues are probably zero, which is fine. But if they have good balance sheets and they can get through this, at some point, like you have to make an assumption that the life will continue at some point, like the normal life.
So you're talking about like a company like potentially like an Expedia or a Bookings.com, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
That would obviously pick up first because they'd be the first thing that will happen was people when they go back to traveling is they're going to use some of these services to book it, even though travel is 4 months in advance.
Exactly. So yeah, and they have those are good businesses in general. Like we spent actually it's kind of funny. We in January when the coronavirus thing started to happen in China, we spent a lot of time looking at these businesses, thinking, okay, well, I'll be honest, I'm somewhat embarrassed now for this. I was thinking this is more like a China problem. Maybe more like Chinese going to Europe problem.
Right. No, that's you shouldn't be embarrassed. I mean, that's what it was.
Yeah. No. So our analysis was, well, their business will be down, and the stocks will decline. What price do we want to pay for them?
Right.
And so we spent a lot of time analyzing them, and now this research actually becomes very useful because we know what we want to own at what prices. We may have to readjust our pricing a little bit, which is fine, the evaluation a little bit, but that's fine. But we've done most of the work in January. So that's how I'm looking at this. I think quality, here's the thing. When you and I look at this, how this is going to play out, the outcomes are extremely wide. This thing could be over in 3 months. That's one of the probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
This thing could be over in 6 months or a year. And the longer it lasts, the impact is not like, let's say impact of 6 months versus 3 months is not twice as bad. It becomes exponential. It becomes a lot better, a lot more. It becomes 5 times more bad, 5 times worse. And the reason for that, because you're going to have it's going to start trickling through the credit. So the banks, start having huge problems. So my thinking is, so this is why every decision I make today, I would err on the side that's going to last a year.
Oh, don't say okay? that. Oh. Oh, it got me in the eye. That's not good. I mean, some of these companies can't last 3 weeks, it seems.
Well, that's my point. So I would, because I'm managing somebody else's life savings, and you are too. So I would err on the side of that it may last a year. And if I'm wrong, you guess what? I'm going to make him less money. But you know what? I'll get through that. And my clients will be happy that by the amount of risk we took.
So in terms of this order of magnitude increase in risk the longer this goes. I think we all are aware of that. You know, one of the problems, tell me what you think about this, because one of the problems has been everybody's like, oh, you know, credit is cheap, or bonds, debt is cheap, and companies are buying this debt, or not buying, they're issuing the debt, and people are buying it up like crazy. There was like nonstop, insatiable appetite to buy this debt, right? I mean, and that's because you got the sovereigns involved, and I am certain that all the sovereigns sucking up all the debt around the world to and the pension plans sucking up all the debt because they have to meet their numbers, and the low interest rates are a big reason why we're that much worse off. Because if there was, think about this, it's very simple, right? If you own your house outright and you lose your job, not as big of a deal if you own your house, but you have a massive mortgage on it. And even though the cost factors right now are low, corporations issued more debt than ever, not to mention the sovereigns, right? And we are going to get ourselves into a credit problem because if you don't have the cash flow, it's a Ponzi scheme, let's be honest. And if you don't have the cash flow to keep this thing going, you're going to start digging into your balance sheets and you're going to start really having some problems with any cash that you have on the books. That's why a lot of these oil companies, with the oil prices down, then double hit with this, you know, the problem with demand are just, you know, obliterated. I mean, are you looking in the oil space?
Yeah, so let me make I'm going to answer the oil question because I want to make a very important point. I think our economy in general and our companies have been maximized for efficiency, not resiliency, right?
Right, exactly.
Because the good times continued for so long that why would we care about risks? There are no risks, right? And when that happens, you have a lot more leverage. So I was concerned about that. And so one thing we did actually, which I hope it would not work out. We bought puts on corporate bonds ETF, LQD. Mm-hmm. And that thing just sticks, you know, and we're far out of the money. And then, you know, I never thought it would make money on this. I hope we wouldn't. But it's now it's one of the sources of returns. So, but I think the point you're making is so important because we did tax cuts 2 years ago, just, you know, on the economy that was growing 3%, you know, on a very on the economy that was in its prime, right? Like okay. So we're cutting rates when the economy was doing okay, and so we are basically trying to stimulate a very healthy, you know, well, somewhat healthy patient. And now when...
Oh, it was steroids. It was steroids.
Exactly. And so we are steroided, and now we need to spend trillions of dollars to get through this. So this is, you know, so that's point number one. About oil. So we bought an oil stock in December. And I wrote about it. And my thinking at the time was the oil prices had been low for so long, and the shale producers kind of were shaky because a lot of them were losing money and levered. That at some point, most likely, we're going to have the supply will decline and oil prices will go up just because kind of low oil prices will cause high oil prices. You know, it's kind of when we were making a decision what to buy, I erred on one of the highest quality companies out there. We bought Equinor, which is basically a Norwegian oil company, mm-hmm. which is used to be called Statoil, which is Norwegian. Basically, you know, like Norway has a $1 trillion fund.
Yeah, sovereign debt fund. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where it's coming
sovereign
from.
Sovereign wealth
you
fund.
Know,
yeah.
It's, you know, Equinor is the source of that. So, and our thinking was, if oil prices go up a lot, this thing will go up, and, you know, it's probably may not be as much as the riskier companies, but it will, you know, if oil prices stay here, we're going to collect, you know, whatever, 6 or 7% dividend, and, you know, production is still growing. And if oil prices decline, they'll be the last man standing. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of our approach to this. So, like, so when the oil prices declined, well, you know, so this company will probably going to cut the dividend. I have no problem with that. Okay. But one thing about the low oil prices today, I think actually it's very beneficial for oil 6 months from now, a year from now, because these low oil prices destroy supply.
And it takes out the frackers. It takes out the drillers, and therefore what you're saying is, I'm going to go to the end solution here, or end of this discussion, is that, well, there's going to be a lot less potential supply coming up, and then if demand comes back online, oil prices go up dramatically.
Exactly. And you want to own the last man standing. Like, so there's a Nassim Taleb, you know, wrote this book called Antifragile, and he talks about the three type of companies: fragile, robust, and antifragile. Fragile companies are the, you know, would be the shale companies today. Robust companies would be companies would basically would come out okay, but would not necessarily benefit from this. And antifragile, the companies that basically end up taking market, you know, come out, they're robust, but they also will take market share and they'll come out stronger. So Equinor is somewhere between robust and fragile. I mean, is antifragile. They're probably closer to robust. Other companies we are looking today, we are asking, okay, is this the company when this is all over will come out, like, will benefit from the crisis? And I'll give you a name we started to nibble into: Berkshire Hathaway. Warren Buffett has $120 billion of cash. He's basically kind of became the corporate lender of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
You
wonder if that's what he was waiting for.
Exactly.
Because he hasn't done any acquisitions in forever.
He was criticized 2 months ago for having this much cash. Yeah, you know, Warren Buffett lost his touch. I love those articles. And he, you know, and in reality, this $120 billion of cash is probably worth double or triple that after this is over.
But isn't that exactly the problem? We have been investors have been rewarding companies that were, and I've been talking about this for so many years, I can't even tell you, rewarding companies for their share buybacks, which effectively we know, you and I, that is a form of financial engineering for the benefit of earnings and stock, keeping stock prices afloat, and not keeping cash on the books, because people that had cash on the books, like Apple forever, was valued at a much lower multiple because of all the cash they had, till people said, oh, let's buy Apple anyway. And Berkshire, the same thing. And, you know, you look at a company like Apple, and while their sales may decline significantly, and while, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the entire situation, they still have bukus of bucks on the balance sheet, right, that can allow them to pretty much skate through anything.
Well, so let me agree with your first point, and we'll come back to Apple in a second. So I agree with you 100%, and I think it really comes down to the management, right? If you have, if somebody is a professional management who is there to maximize shareholder value, their time horizon is usually measured in quarters, right?
Right.
And therefore, they're not thinking about resiliency. They're just thinking about their paycheck that's tied to earnings per share, right? Which is, you know, very, you know, short term. If you have somebody who is own operator who owns a lot of the stock, then suddenly they're, you know, if they own 10 or 20% of the company, suddenly their time horizon is different than just from professional manager, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is why, to me, it's incredibly important to see, you know, to understand the management, you know. And so when we analyze management, we look at two things: how well they run the business and how well they allocate capital, right? So that answers your first point. So I agree with you 100%. Let's talk about Apple, actually. So Apple, I just looked at it a few days ago. Apple used to have a net cash balance sheet, like by hundreds of billions of dollars. They have a few billion dollars left of net cash. So they can weather the storm because a lot of that debt, you know, has long-term maturities. But this is a company that have bought a lot of stock, or, you know, that had to basically, they have as much cash now basically as they have debt. So even Apple, probably spent too much money on buying its stock, you know. And so I wish they had more cash so they could take advantage of the potential weakness in their stock price.
But the problem here has been also not only the corporate, the mindset of the corporations on the quarter-to-quarter-to-quarter deal, because that's the only way they could really appease investors, but the activists too. I mean, I'm really kind of coming to the point that, and I've always had this, but you know what? These activists who were just in there to figure out how to manipulate whatever was going on, you know, and some of that may be good, but it was always down to the bottom line of, hey, how can I get the most out of my shares here? Which is not a bad thing. You're an investor. That's what you should be doing. But to a point that they somehow wowed and mesmerized management to do things that they should have never done.
I agree with you. So it's I don't want to put all activists in a bad category. It really comes down to the time horizon, right? If you're an activist and you're just trying to create a pop in the stock and then be out, you're probably going to cause damage to the company, right?
Right, exactly.
But if you're an activist and you come to the company that has been mismanaged, right? And you are turned around and you're willing to stick around for a long time, then it's a good thing. I mean, like, I'll give you an example. In Canada, there was a railroad, there was still a railroad called Canada Pacific, right? Mm-hmm. And activists brought a new management team, which really have improved the railroad as a business. And it's, you know, because of the activists, it's a much better company today than it was before, you know. So activists can create value, but at the same time that activists stuck around for a long time. And that's, so he was basically a long-term investor who changed the governance, right? So it could be, activists could be good force and bad force. So I don't want to put everybody in the, you know.
So how about we do this? We'll call the activists that are looking at bettering the company, the management, the structure into one category. And then there's the activists that we'll call a corporate raider. That is the ones that are looking to really just make a quick pop by maybe cutting some parts of the business, gouging maybe employees and just doing it for the next, you know, 6 months or 1 year.
I agree with you 100%. And that's absolutely.
So now, you know, you wrote this article called The Impact of Coronavirus, People, Economy, and Your Portfolio. And, you know, I think we agree that we're because we talked before, but that this is going to be, in our lifetimes, probably the worst economic event due to this way this is structured. My concern is that it's going to leave a lasting imprint on people, not just investors, people, to a point that, you know, almost like a, you know, this is kind of like, you know, you're being in war and you're coming out and you have a depression and a constant reminder every time flu season comes around that you would be shocked, shell-shocked, and almost have a you know, PTSD kind of situation going on. Now, we are resilient, and economies are, people are, et cetera. We all know what we have to be doing right now. And in the end, you know, you look at some of the other things like the annual flu rates and what's going on there and how many people die on a regular basis from obesity or lung cancer or whatever, you know, whatever it is. I don't know if we're going to get to that point. If we saw the spike in Italy at 8% mortality rate for this and how much more that's going to go. But shutting down the economy is the equivalent of what happened during the Depression, isn't it?
It's a war. Like, it's like I'm treating this as a war. Like, so this is a very interesting topic because we as the United States have never really had a war on this soil, right? You can say 9/11. Like, I'm not talking about civil war. I'm talking about being attacked by a foreign entity.
Right. Yeah.
You can say 9/11 was probably as close, Pearl Harbor kind of, you know, but Hawaii was not really part of the United States then yet. But anyway, but that's we really never had a war on this soil, right? And therefore, we've been spoiled, right? Because we have we got two oceans on different sides. We got Mexico and Canada, so we kind of it's a good thing, right? We had a huge comfort for last many hundreds of years. Okay, now if you look at countries like Israel, for instance, right? And my son just came from Israel, and he was doing an internship there. And Israel basically always lives in the state of war. So the relationship the government of Israel has with its people is a democracy, but it's a very different relationship that we have with our government. The Israel basically right now on the martial law, like not quite, no, it's basically on lockdown. So my son basically was told you can go to the store and that's about it. You can't even go to the park. So, you know, they want you to stay at home. And people said, well, people trust the government that this is a wartime and that's what we're doing. So the way I'm looking at it, you know, the way I'm looking at the coronavirus today, which is actually very different than it was 2 weeks ago when I wrote that article you're referring to, the article was already obsolete because so much changed in my mind. We are at war And for, we need to go on a lockdown. And to do the, the reason we need to do this, because if we just, you know, if we basically contain the spread of the virus, and we're basically going to buy time. There was a cost to the economy, but that cost is going to be so much smaller if we don't do this. But the reason we need to buy time, because it's one of the two things may happen, maybe three things. Number one, will the drug companies will come up with a, you know, with a cure.
Yes.
You know, it, you know, that's number one. And I'll tell you this, capitalism, like, this is the time when you want to praise capitalism. Okay. Yeah. Even though government is sending out checks right now, which is anything but capitalism. Okay. But at the same time, the corporate America, the one, you know, corporate Europe as well, I guess, they're looking for cure 24/7. So, and I'm, you know, and I think I'm sure they'll find a cure. It's a question when. Then second thing is that even if we don't find a cure very quickly, testing has been incredibly successful in South Korea. And testing can actually, if we in 2 or 3 weeks, if we have enough testing to start testing everybody, that could be a huge solution. You know, that could be very beneficial. And third, and this is where, like, I'm like, this is more like a hope than anything else. Maybe this, you know, maybe the sun will cure this. Who knows? So my point is, we need to buy time. And I think the lockdown is necessary. And I think we are probably days away from having a kind of almost like a martial law. In
the don't say it. Don't say it. I don't want to hear.
Oh,
it.
No, this is like what's happening in California is going to be across the whole country. So, and so I'm.
Well, then you
and, and you know what? And that's fine. I want us to overreact because here's the problem. We were, under, you know, we are so used to bad things happening to somebody else, but not us, that we are underreacting. So you and I'm guilty of this. I was looking at China and say, well, these things can only happen in China. Well, we were wrong. And so I'm, you know.
The question, though, is if you shut everything down, or at least non-essential, which I'm not exactly sure what that becomes. And if people have an office somewhere, if they're the only person in the office, if that's okay to go to, or if it means that, you know, I don't even know what the exact definition of shut everything down, if it's just public meeting places, places that clients can go to, people that people could eat, the economy goes into a free fall. And, you know, restarting that is like, you know, trying to restart a diesel engine that has been running for the last 50 years and you turn off for a while and then you got to do a lot of cranking to get that going again.
So that's a great question. So the I compare this to when 2008 was running the bank, this running the economy, and the government today, you know, is kind of playing the role of Federal Reserve and it's basically saying, we're going to provide money. So you and I, like people and wealthier people can get through this, you know, fine for a certain period of time. People who, low-income people who are going to have a hard time doing this, right? So government coming in and basically giving people money to survive for next 2 weeks or 3 weeks or month, whatever, will dampen the effect of this. However, there is a cost, right? And it's going to cost trillions of dollars. And that changes the equation of what's going to happen. We're going to have inflation or deflation, right? So there is a cost that, you know, we're going to have to pay for that at some point, right? But that cost is still so much, you know, that cost is still so much smaller cost if we don't do this, right?
You know what,
so
I blame? Can I tell you who I blame part of this problem on right now? It's the Fed. And I know that everybody's like, what do you always blame the Fed? The Fed's move last year, because we saw that stock market tick down.
Yeah.
And they did the pivot, and they could have just done a pivot without any rate decreases.
Absolutely.
And had a lot more powder, but somehow, I don't even know what they were thinking, because what was on the horizon really was nothing. A little bit of a tick down in the GDP and all that. There was no reason for them to stimulate at that point. They would have had 0.75%. You know how much that would have been usable and useful for in this environment?
I can't argue with that. I mean, I think you're right, and I think it was a political move than anything else. However, so I wrote this article that you're referring to, you know, about coronavirus, and I wrote it almost 3 weeks ago now. Mm-hmm. And I look at this article, and there was one underlying assumption, and I was basically saying expect recession.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wrong in a sense that I was basically saying that this is not going to be as bad as China. And my argument was, we have a lead time. And we have a lead time. And so therefore we can react fast. China showed us how bad it could look, and our government will react and we'll be fine, et cetera. It's not going to be as bad. I was wrong about the government response. The government response was so inadequate. And I think this is why, this is where every minute, the 1 week of time now is very expensive. So I think now government was underreacting, and now hopefully it looks like they are overreacting now, which is fine with me.
Look at the Chinese stock market, and that didn't take as much of a dip as ours did.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was actually pretty darn stable. I mean, it took a little bit of a dip to begin with, and it wasn't as high as ours was to begin with. That's why I think we had to deflate all that excess from last year, which was my initial plan. We would deflate that. I didn't think it was going to go, like I said, this far. And that's why we came in so light on the equities. But so with that in mind, mm-hmm. I think what you're telling me is that you're still confident that you can find great bargains, whether it's, sector-based, individual equities, et cetera, lightening up on the new buys, right? Because you have a portfolio of positions already. But yeah. Lightening up on the new buys, okay? And then looking out at this thing a couple years down the road, however long, and realizing that this too shall end. Is that the point?
That's exactly. So we were positioning for recession. Our portfolio was positioned as if recession came tomorrow. Obviously, we did not position for coronavirus, and this is kind of an advanced version of recession, a slightly different recession. Mm-hmm. But yes, I'm basically saying I'm making decisions 3 years from now. Like, think about March 2009. That was the bottom of the market, mm-hmm. but it was anything but the bottom of the crisis, right?
Right.
Like at least you could not tell, right? At the time, you would read headlines and they were as scary as the ones, a month before, the month after. So you could never, it's incredibly difficult to time the market. And the way I look at this, I'm, as long as I am buying businesses that will survive and strive 3 years from now, that is the best thing that happened to my clients' portfolios. Not to my clients, but right. their portfolios.
I
want to stress this point because it's so, I don't know if you can hear my excitement.
I hear it.
But it's really, I'm really, as a portfolio manager, this is I actually, I'm working 12-hour days right now because there are so many stocks I can look through now and say, oh my God, do I want to own this great business at this price or the other one?
Yeah.
However, there's one caveat. The market declined, 30-something percent? Mm-hmm. And there are still a lot of very expensive companies.
I know that. And it's funny because, like I said, we look at our positioning and as light as we were, and I also tell you that I've gotten in over the last couple of weeks, a lot of people asking me to review their portfolios because we did this special birthday. I did a kind of my birthday's today, actually.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'll remember this one. The thing is that we ask people, hey, do me a favor, send me your portfolios for this month for my birthday. I'm going to do free portfolio reviews, and that's available over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew, drop it down, and you can do a secure upload of your portfolio. And I can't tell you how many portfolios that I've seen that are absolutely decimated. Somebody had $103,000 on December 31st, let's say, and they're at, 58,000 now.
We had a person who reached out to us, a month ago, and it was $500,000 portfolio. Our minimum account size is $500,000. $500,000 portfolio. And then she called us up and said, I can't. I was levered and I lost my money. Oh. So this is very unfortunate, but also this is basically, I think part of the reason why this move in the market, there are many reasons why the move in the market was so violent. Mm-hmm. But a part of the reason was there are so many people that were forced into equities. And this is right. When you say blame Federal Reserve, yes, blame Federal Reserve for that. Because people were hungry for any yield. People were hungry for any return.
Right.
Right. And the bonds did not offer that. And so what happened basically, everybody, and you and I actually, Andrew, if you look back at our discussions a few years ago, you and I had this discussion.
Yeah.
Where I basically said, everybody was forced to take more risk. And I was, you know, so you and I had to take a career risk because we, I said, I'm not going to do this.
Right.
I just,
right.
you know, and so I'm taking career risk because I'm going to say, I'm going to have a lot more cash and we're going to err, you know, to own companies that are, that I don't have to worry about their valuations being cut in, you know, in 70% and they're not seeing the valuation ever again. So I think this is, you know, this is exactly, you know, why the move was so violent. And I think for, you know, for those expensive stocks, it's still not over.
I would tend to agree with you. I mean, the thing is, I mean, there are some companies that are quote unquote expensive that still probably have some great value. Microsoft, you know, whether it's exactly expensive now or not, Microsoft is solid. I mean, they have a lot of components to it. They have a solid company, you know, even though you may have less seats that you're going to be utilizing and paying them. I mean, can we find fault with Microsoft? There's no replacement. Yeah.
No. I actually, so I haven't looked at Microsoft in a while. We used to own it actually a long time ago. My only point there would be, so as you talk about the business, I would argue Microsoft business is going to be a strong, you know, stronger 3 years from now than it is today. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, however, it's the question is, what is Microsoft value? You know, the value of the business. So I was Microsoft business overvalued today, and therefore, like, you know, in 1999, Microsoft was still a great company, but the stock has gone nowhere for 10 years because it was still a great business and growing, but the stock was just too expensive, right?
Yeah, right.
So I think that's really, this is where they are, you know, this is where the issues are. There are some great companies. So the investors were making kind of a binary, one-dimensional decision a lot of times. They would say, this is a great company and I want to own it. But what they did not go a step further and say, you know, this is a great company, but is that a good investment?
Right. No, I hear you.
There was a difference. So if I own Microsoft, I can't even speak about Microsoft because we haven't valued it in a long time. So
again, just an example. But anyway, I encourage everybody to check out Vitaly's site and go over to either investor.fm or just look up Contrarian Edge, and you can find out all sorts of information. We'll have the links to get there over on the Disciplined Investor on the episode for show page or show notes page for number, what are we at? 654.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I've been doing this since 07, my friend.
Oh, God.
07. Well,
that's why you're so good.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
No, you're very good.
I appreciate it. Listen, you stay safe. Hugs and kisses to your family, and hopefully we'll meet on the other side. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. We'll talk when it's over and we'll look at this as a interesting time.
Yeah, exactly. All right, buddy. I'll see you soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Please, like I said, make sure you understand and really believe that we're all here together working this situation as best as we can, doing our best. Be kind to each other. Be understanding. Be patient with each other. And I think we'll come out of this just fine. I really do believe that. Again, make sure to follow me on Twitter because that's where you'll get some of the information about when the podcasts come out. Also, our pop-up webinars where we'll do Q&A, answer any questions that you have. And I'm going to see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.